You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is a combined issue for December of 2022 and January of 2023, and this is Vanity Fair Part B. Inventing Ivana. Ivana Marie Zelnikova Trump escaped from behind the Iron Curtain to storm New York City and help define its greed is good era. From her heyday presiding over her husband's properties to her decadent post-Donald denouement selling costume jewelry and cavorting with a series of freaky Italian lovers, it was Ivana all along who gilded the Trump name. By Mark Seal. Opening photo, All That Glitters, Ivana Trump in 1986 at Mar-a-Lago, which she restored. Act 1, The Staircase. She is alone in her seven-story East 64th Street townhouse, atop the steep, spiraling stairs that friends and family have warned could kill her. Tomorrow, July 15, 2022, she is scheduled to fly to Saint-Tropez, her first flight since the isolation of COVID. No one knows when she takes her final step, but some will find comfort when her body is reportedly found in pajamas with a coffee cup instead of a champagne flute nearby. They hope she fell in the early morning hours instead of the darkness of night. It's been 9 months since she buried her fourth husband, the handsome Italian playboy Rossano Rubicondi. Rossano might have been financially needy and more than two decades her junior, but he made her feel young again. Now, 73, or so they say, Ivana has more memories behind her than ahead, but her Louis Vuitton suitcases are filled with her famous shoes, and she is ready to dance on the French Riviera once again. Those shoes, Christian Louboutins and Manolos and Jimmy Choo's, became part of her legend when she was the first wife of Donald J. Trump, whom she, in her Czech-inflected English, famously called the Donald. By the time he became president, they had both remarried a couple of times. But in 2017, Ivana told ABC News, "I'm basically first Trump wife. I'm first lady, okay?" Her stoic, smiling facade reflecting her pride, but hiding her terror. Her true feelings would come pouring out in the New York atelier of her longtime fashion designer, Mark Bauer, to whom she had come for a fitting on January 11, 2017, 9 days before Trump's inauguration. Always with Ivana, it was fun. Fun fittings and champagne and parties, says Bauer. But this time, he noticed something as soon as she stepped off the elevator. The Manolo Blahniks looked slightly scuffed, the toes dented a bit, and not nearly as immaculate as they always had been. Ivana ordered a half-dozen tight-fitting, body-hugging, jewel-tone dresses. Then they retired to a couch, the designer and his business partner, Paul Margolin, sitting on either side of Ivana. "So how's everything going?" they ask. "Do you need a dress for the inauguration?" She said, "I don't know if I'm going to go," remembers Bauer. Then she started sobbing, uncontrollably, tears pouring down her face. We both cradled her in our arms, saying, "Everything's going to be okay." Her words came out in a torrent. "They hate me. They all hate me," Bauer remembers Ivana wailing. "Everywhere I go, they say things and they shout things at me. Outside my house in Saint-Tropez, Palm Beach, everywhere, they hate me." Through her sobs, she added, "It's not my fault. I am not him. I divorced him a long time ago. I do not deserve this." The designer was taken aback. "I had to fight back tears myself," he says, "because here was this woman I greatly respected and loved, totally broken down." Next photos, better half. An early modeling shot, 1971. Ivana's hometown, Gottwaldow, 1949. Her first wedding to an Austrian guy named Alfred Winkelmayer, 1971. A Trump family portrait, complete with junior power ties, 1986. But wait, Ivana wouldn't want you to see her like this, gone from a size 8 to a 14, according to Bauer, and as her longtime nanny-turned-assistant would say at her funeral, adrift in a sinking swamp of parasites with illicit dreams and schemes, especially not in the pages of Vanity Fair, which so lavishly chronicled her heyday that a blow-up of her May 1992 cover would stand near the casket at her funeral. No, Ivana would want to turn back the clock and let the spotlight shine on her in her 1980s prime, heels high, shoulders padded, blonde hair big, her smile flashing at 100 watts. A superstar, straight out of the era's defining primetime soaps, Dallas and Dynasty. To get there, she had made an unfathomable journey across geographic and social divides, escaping communist Czechoslovakia, before flying into Canada on the wings of a marriage of convenience and her credentials as a competitive skier. She was 27 when, in 1976, she finally made it to New York as a runway model. It was there, rocking a blood-red mini-dress in the company of seven other models, that she met her prince. "I love a good-looking man," she said on the Oprah Winfrey Show, then added, "but you know, it's really with the look and the brain and the energy and the really potentials, and, you know, Donald always had a great head on his shoulders, and I saw the potential there." "She speaks a little lousy, but she's gorgeous, and I'm going to marry her," Trump would later be quoted as saying. Their wedding, technically her second, took place on April 7, 1977, at Marble Collegiate in Manhattan. So began the fertile period, when Ivana helped her husband design, construct, decorate, and run his landmarks. "I will pay her $1 a year and all the dresses she can buy," Trump famously said, a comment that supposedly devastated his wife, who was rising fast in the ranks of the Trump organization. She took the dresses and the shoes, and buildings rose in her wake. The Grand Hyatt, 1979, Trump Tower, 1983, Trump Plaza in Atlantic City, 1984, and the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, 1990. Ivana restored the couple's new home, Marjorie Meriwether Post gargantuan 118-room Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, as well as Trump Princess, the 282-foot yacht Trump purchased from the Sultan of Brunei for $30 million in 1987. Under her influence, the Donald traded his burgundy queen's suits for Brioni, and he and Ivana ascended from developers to stars. In a decade of glitz, they were the glitziest. In a decade of greed, they were the greediest, reported People. 13 years and three children later, the fairy tale fractured, spawning the decade's biggest tabloid divorce scandal. Then Ivana staged an explosive comeback, fueled by the realization that her first name was as powerful as her last. She was indomitable, a friend says. Her mother is still alive at 96. She would never have thought she would fall down those stairs. Ivana's story is in many ways even bigger, grander, and more extraordinary than her ex-husband's. It's a saga worthy of a Broadway musical or an opera. But before the fall on those cursed stairs, where she would be found by her housekeeper at 12:40 p.m., her story begins with a climb. Next photos, gold medal. Attending Roy Cohn's birthday party with Donald Trump, 1980. Flaunting serious fur at the Plaza Hotel, 1989. Reuniting with her friend, fellow competitive skier, and sometime savior George Sirovka, 2000. Act Two, The Climb. How does a barbed wire girl from a shoe factory town behind the Iron Curtain escape to America, define the greed-is-good 1980s, and help create the twisted miracle of Donald J. Trump? An only child, born 8 weeks premature on February 20th, 1949, she is bestowed with a Russian first name. Maybe they thought it would help me with the Soviets. By her parents, an electrical engineer and a telephone operator. The family lives in a concrete house on the grounds of the Bata shoe factory complex in the town of Gotwaldov, where everyone toes the party line but Ivana Marie Zelnevkova. She meets the competitive skier George Sirovka at 14 and starts dating him at 17. When the communists relax restrictions during the Prague Spring of the 1960s, they begin traveling together. She has acquired the taste of the Western world. Freedom, fashion, money, Sirovka will remember. She models, she acts, she wins roles in Czech movies and comparisons to Brigitte Bardot. And she changed her brown hair to blonde to look more like her, says Sirovka. Then, in 1968, the Prague Spring ends, and Ivana is grounded once more. To defect would mean never seeing her parents again, and possibly putting them in danger. Sirovka finds a solution when he meets a young Austrian guy named Alfred Winkelmayr, and in 1971 persuades him to marry Ivana on paper so she can come and go between Czechoslovakia and other countries. Surprisingly, he agreed, says Sirovka. Sirovka moves to London for work, but arranges for Ivana to live in his family's large and beautiful apartment in Prague, while she earns her master's degree in physical education at Charles University. Here, she finds true love for the first time, not with Sirovka, but with Czechoslovakia's premier young poet and songwriter Jiří Steitel, 30. He writes her love songs. She becomes his muse. A heavy boozer and reckless bon vivant, who a friend will say drove like he was grabbing death by the ass, Steitel is speeding in his sports car on the night of October 9, 1973, with several shots in him and an unknown beauty in the passenger seat, reports a Czech newspaper. When a truck slams into the car, Steitel is propelled out of the vehicle and hits the guardrail, dying on the spot. The unknown beauty is thrown into the back seat, but by some miracle, she walks away without a scratch. The newspaper identifies her only by her initials, I-Z. Ivana Zelnevkova? It probably was Ivana in the car, but she has denied it, and I have never pressed her further, says Sirovka, who invites her to share his home and new life in Montreal. At 24, she drives her Fiat to the Prague airport, and with her pet poodle, Chappie, flies off into the new world. She stays for a time with an aunt and uncle in Toronto. They take her on a Caribbean cruise, where, for a shipside costume party, she dresses as a Playboy bunny, and I won first prize. Seeking friends, she accepts an onboard date with a sailor, who shows her that Western men can be worse than the communist back home. He invited me to his cabin and tried to rape me, she will write in her 2017 memoir, Raising Trump. In Montreal, Ivana begins her rise as a model, walking runways and posing in fashion magazines. I wish 10 more like her would walk through the door right now, the modeling agency director marvels, noting her perfect height and size and her good head for fashion, attributes that will soon entice a rising Queens-born real estate developer. It is summer 1976. Donald Trump has just turned 30, but in his mind, he's already a mogul. After a long day of looking at properties, he and Gerald Goldsmith, the chairman of a private club in Manhattan, are unwinding at Maxwell's Plum, a vast restaurant and bar at 64th Street and First Avenue, known for its selection of sex and food. Trump's eagle eyes focus on a blonde woman in a red mini dress surrounded by seven other models. Having just arrived in New York from Montreal, Ivana Zelnikova-Winkelmeyer, age 27, is in town for a fashion show to promote the 1976 Olympics. "Gee, I like that girl," says Trump, and he is immediately upon her, his uninvited hand on her arm. She spins around, ready to give whoever has the gall to touch her the commie death stare. Now she sees him for the first time, the man the New York Times will describe 2 months from now as tall, lean, and blonde, with dazzling white teeth like Robert Redford, with a self-proclaimed net worth of more than $200 million. All of which means absolutely nothing to Ivana. "I wasn't a blushing virgin," she'll later explain, adding that she'd been hit on by countless men since the age of 14. "I knew every seduction trick in the book." She had to cross a world to get to Manhattan. Trump only had to cross a bridge. To her, he is just a nice guy, gallantly offering to get her and her fellow models a table, where he joins them for dinner and pays their $400 tab. With that, Trump begins his relentless courtship. A Trump number, he calls it, all enveloping. Trump, whose whole life has been all about him, is suddenly all about Ivana, gushing to friends and family, "Have you ever seen anybody more beautiful? You know she speaks French, Russian, and Czech. Do you know that she is the greatest skier in the world?" "Donald says I am his twin, as a woman," Ivana will later say. In an ABC documentary, the columnist Linda Stasi will add, "He's such a narcissist, it was like being married to himself." After months of dating, she gives in to his onslaught of marriage proposals. But before they can wed, on April 7th, 1977, she must survive a negotiation with Trump's notorious attorney Roy Cohn over the prenuptial agreement. "I did not speak very well English, and it did not exist in communist Czechoslovakia," she will later say. It includes a give-back clause, requiring Ivana to return any and all gifts, including jewelry, that she receives over the course of her marriage. "No the effing way," she will say, demanding a rainy day fund to compensate her for the $50,000 a year she is making as a model. Trump reportedly deposits $100,000 into Ivana's independent bank account and promises $20,000 for the first year of wedlock, and an escalating amount for each year up to $90,000 after 30 years. Then, before a congregation of 200, Mr. and Mrs. Donald Trump begin their epic ascent. Next photos, divorce majeure. Debuting her post-Donald hairstyle on the cover of Vogue 1990, with third husband Ricardo Mazzucchelli 1997, at the wheel of My Ivana, 1996. Repping her namesake brand, 1994. Flying by luxury helicopter from Atlantic City to New York City, 1987. She becomes pregnant on their honeymoon with Don Jr. Ivanka and Eric follow in rapid succession. "I would give the birth and I would be at my office 2 days later," she tells Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. She becomes a devoted mom whose family is her number one priority. Quick to spot an unutilized asset, Trump dispatches his twin into the trenches of New York City real estate development. "I'm going to work for the Donald," Ivana tells her pal Nikki Haskell over lunch early in the marriage. "I'm going to work on the construction site." "What?" Haskell exclaims, knowing Ivana is referring to the old Commodore Hotel, the dump Trump is redeveloping as the Hyatt Grand in a dangerous, rundown neighborhood near Grand Central Station. Ivana laughs. They don't know who they're dealing with. She moves a mountain of marble into the soaring, soon-to-be pink lobby of Trump Tower, renovates the ancient, crumbling Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, and becomes CEO of the Trump Castle Hotel and casino in Atlantic City. Finally, in March 1988, after Trump buys the iconic Plaza Hotel in the heart of Manhattan, he installs Ivana as its president. If Ivana hadn't been involved in his business, there would have been no business, Haskell said on the ABC News studio documentary, The Ivana Trump Story, The First Wife. As the buildings grow, along with the dresses, a wardrobe the Times estimates costs Trump $1.5 million a year, Ivana becomes a pivotal force in building the phenomenon of Donald J. Trump. He didn't know a king and a queen and a princess if he fell over them, the gossip columnist Cindy Adams said on the Ivana Trump Story. She opened up all of that to him. He would have never been on The Apprentice without the image that she created, and he would never have been president without The Apprentice, said the author Paula Froelich. Ivana not only loved Trump, she was tethered to Trump so tightly that he would tell Oprah Winfrey in a joint interview, "We get along very well, because ultimately Ivana does exactly as I tell her to do." Until she didn't. Some said she began to aspire to things he despised: society, charity boards, fashion shows, grand balls, and grand people. The phonies, Trump called them. He didn't want a co-pilot. One longtime Trump observer will later say he wanted a cheerleader. Soon, the camera shone more on her and less on him, and he was not going to have it, said Adams. The divorce sweeps the world. A tawdry romance novel sprung to life. It opens with Trump and his mistress, Marla Maples, creasing the sheets in Trump-owned hotels. Everyone seems to know, except Ivana. I always stand by the man, she says. Now, she is standing in the three-bedroom suite in the Little Nell Hotel in Aspen. It is the Christmas holiday of 1989, and Ivana, at 40, has been reborn via a makeover by the renowned cosmetic surgeon Steve Heflin. She's had a facelift, a bosom inflation, and heaven only knows what else, wrote Liz Smith, who didn't recognize the new Ivana until she spoke. Inside the suite, she picks up a landline and hears her husband on the extension speaking to a local real estate agent about someone whose name she hasn't heard before. Who is Mula? She demands. Well, that's a girl who has been going after me for the last 2 years, Trump replies. Somehow, Trump has juggled Ivana and the 26-year-old Maples at holiday parties, keeping them separate and seemingly satisfied. But his luck runs out at Bonnie's, the rustic lunch spot at the top of Aspen Mountain. He's sitting with Marla and some friends when Ivana walks in, trailed by Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. Marla, in a black ski suit, approaches Ivana in red and pink and delivers a line that, as an aspiring actor, she has surely rehearsed. I'm Marla, and I love your husband. Do you? In an instant, Ivana replies, get lost. I love my husband. Then, as she has done all her life, Ivana charges, not at Mula, at the Donald. We were halfway through lunch, and she's coming toward us screaming, you no good son of a bitch, says someone who was at Trump's table. Trump intercepts her halfway across the crowded room, and she's just flailing on him. Ask for comment, Marla Maples did not respond. They exit, and the lunch crowd rises as one to watch from the deck. He clicks into his skis, and you could tell that she's looking at him like, really? You're going to try to ski away from me? He tries, but she is fast on his tail. Back at the Little Nell, Ivana hurls her husband's clothes and Rolex watch out of the windows of their suite and into the snow. Next comes the unthinkable, at least for Trump. Everyone seems to side with her. If the new tabloid media is born with the Trump divorce, it grows through the all-access rise of the new Ivana. She's exactly like Donald in that way, someone tells writer Bob Colicello for his 1992 Vanity Fair story. They live for publicity. It's like a drug for them. A lady getting a divorce, a lady doesn't get photographed for getting a divorce. Ivana did the cover of Vogue. Trailed by paparazzi and Trump's killer lawyers, in the midst of her bloody divorce, she rushes breathlessly into the studio of the photographer Patrick Demarchelier, who is waiting alongside famed hairstylist Mari Hobson, makeup artist Vincent Longo, and creative director Andre Leon Talley, all gathered to style and shoot Ivana for the May 1990 cover of Vogue. Hobson knows Ivana's hair. Everyone does. It's been emblazoned on the cover of every tabloid for weeks. Blonde and worn down in the teased flip, favored by the East Side ladies of the day. As Ivana sits before the mirror, Hobson grabs a handful of her lustrous blonde hair and holds it aloft, letting some of her blonde tendrils fall down around her face. We all looked in the mirror and agreed, well, that's it. In that moment, Ivana Trump's famous new hairstyle is born. Soon it will be imitated worldwide. You don't have to put down the second name, she commands a writer for the New York Times. Ivana is what the people call me. They say, hi, Ivana. The name becomes emblematic for women around the world who love her because she won. She and her legal team go to war over the $25 million stipulated in Cohn's prenup, fighting Trump's fire with fire. In a deposition, she states that Trump, infuriated over a scalp reduction, raped her in 1989. Trump repeatedly denies the allegations. Later, when the deposition is referenced in the book Lost Tycoon by Harry Hurt III, the publisher will insert a statement by Ivana at the beginning saying that it wasn't rape in a literal or criminal sense. When she walks away with both her millions and sole custody of her three kids, the crowds cheer. Best of all, her rise is concurrent with Trump's early 90s financial decline and the bust-up of his marriage to Maples after 6 years. Ivana launches two companies. Ivana, Inc. sells my books, advice columns, commercials, appearances, and lectures, and House of Ivana handles her fragrances, clothes, and jewelry. The TV studio lights beat down upon her now-famous hairstyle as she butchers the King's English and sells a King's ransom in down-market clothes and costume jewelry to Home Shopping Network viewers in the U.S., U.K., and Canada. Absolutely fantastic, she seems to say, of each and every item, from the $49.95 hoop earrings to the $280 Ivana women's tuxedo that smashes HSN records. If you went down the street with her, I guarantee you that women of all sizes will stop and say, look how good I look, I'm wearing your jacket, says her friend Vivian Sirota. Ivana is now a mogul in her own right, spending money as fast as she makes it. She buys her 7-story townhouse on East 64th Street in 1992. There's also a 12,000-square-foot hacienda in Palm Beach, which she names Concha Marina, Spanish for seashell, and a 98-foot, 4-stateroom yacht, which she christens the My Ivana, probably with a bottle of Cristal, the bubbly she promotes as its U.S. spokesperson. One summer day in the late 1990s, Ivana is sunbathing on the bow of the My Ivana of Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat when a helicopter crashes into the bay. Let's go rescue whoever is in there, Ivana's captain Alberto Batani remembers her telling him. They jump into the tender and race to the scene, where they pull two bobbing pilots into their little rescue boat. Upon regaining their senses, the men look at their swimsuit-clad rescuer and shriek, Ivana Trump! In October 1990, Ivana's beloved father Miloš dies of a heart attack. The Donald flies with her to Czechoslovakia for the funeral and tries to win her back, according to Vivian Sirota. On the grave of Miloš, he said to her, I still love you. I don't want a divorce. Let's get back together again. As for Maples, whom Ivana refers to only as the showgirl, he says, "We'll take care of it." And if she wasn't so brokenhearted, maybe they would have stayed married, Sirota says. Instead, she rents a house in London's Eaton Square and escapes there for weekends from the stress of her divorce. Ivana is ubiquitous, from Buckingham Palace to St. Moritz, where 4 months after her father's death, she falls into the arms of Kenneth Lieberman. He's almost perfect, rich, handsome, successful, and in his late 60s, wise and consoling. But married, their very public relationship makes international headlines. Then Lieberman returns to his wife, and Ivana moves on to the first of her freaky Italians, as she will call them. At the horse races at Ascot, she meets Riccardo Mazzucchelli, a London-based international businessman. "He was not a parasite," says Sirota. "He had his own life, his own business. He knew a lot of the people she knew." Before their wedding at Le Cirque in New York, Ivana's attorney asked Mazzucchelli to estimate his net worth for the prenup. He said, $5 million, more or less," remembers the attorney, "and I thought, I'm betting on the less." A zero is how Trump rated Mazzucchelli. He becomes involved in Ivana's businesses. Ivana was on home shopping. She took cabs, stayed in motel rooms, never said boo, says Sirota. She marries Riccardo, and he starts making demands. He became a prima donna. He felt like he was sort of morphing into Mr. Riccardo Trump, says Haskell. He was very upset that nobody referred to Ivana as Mrs. Mazzucchelli. "So we went to Las Vegas, and she had all the rooms reserved under Mr. and Mrs. Mazzucchelli. And everybody was supposed to make sure that they called her Mrs. Mazzucchelli. We went to see Wayne Newton, and he came out on stage and said, 'Ladies and gentlemen, my dear friend Ivana Trump is here.' Riccardo got up and left, and we never saw him again. That was the end of the marriage," says Haskell. With Mazzucchelli gone, Ivana turns to Massimo Gaggia, an Italian publisher known as the King of the Jet Set. "Start looking," she tells Gaggia, who began to search for a man worthy of this beautiful and talented woman. He finds him in Rome, Count Raffredo Gattini dell'Aquila de Aragona di Lorenzana Lovitelli, the eldest of 4 sons and 2 daughters of one of the oldest and most regal families in Italy. Raffredo grew up in a vast Roman palace, and his family tree includes 2 popes. Moreover, he is startlingly handsome, a former professional boxer who shares Ivana's love of adventure and speed. Still in his 40s, with the drive of the Ferraris on display at his 2 New York-area dealerships, Raffredo would bound up Ivana's spiral staircase and into the second-floor living room, where she would be waiting beside the grand piano. "She said he would grab me and we would make love on top of the piano," says Sirota. "The best sex she ever had in her life. She would tell everybody that he was the best lover, and he was a gentleman, and he was very protective." Even Trump gives his blessing, despite being unable to remember Raffredo's name. "Wilfredo was a terrific guy," he tells the New York Times during their courtship. "I hope they both have a good time spending the money that I gave to Ivana." Then, on December 23, 2005, Raffredo goes to visit his mother in the family home, a castle in Tuscany. Driving through the frost in a rental car, he falls asleep at the wheel and runs off the road. The car rolls over several times, and Raffredo, who suffers multiple head injuries, is dead at 52. By then, though, their romance is over, mostly due to a third person in the relationship. Raffredo's boss and mentor, Gianni Agnelli, the principal shareholder of Fiat, which owns Ferrari. Gianni Agnelli was very jealous, says Sirota, and his constant demands on Raffredo's time became too much for Ivana. They had a very big fight. I'm sure if Raffredo was alive, that other creep would never have come into her life. Next photos, her way. on the May 1992 cover of Vanity Fair, with fourth husband Rossano Rubicondi, 2003, in the arms of Count Roffredo Gattani, 1998, with her children Don Jr., Eric, and Ivanka, 2006. Act 3, The Fall. In August 1999, Francine Eternand, 71, who claims to be a Swiss countess, tells police in Porto Cervo, Sardinia, that she has been held prisoner in the bedroom of her villa by her 27-year-old boyfriend. A bodybuilder and aspiring actor from Rome, he wants to attend a party with important people, according to an Italian newspaper. She prefers another intimate evening. She claims he locked her in her room, returning at 4 a.m., drunk from the disco. He kicked in the door, beat me up, taking with him three checkbooks and the two phones. Both parties go to the police. He insists he took only the lodging she offered. Sex? Are we crazy? She could be my grandmother. Eternaud eventually withdraws her complaint. Ah, Rossano, he's a wonderful person, she tells a newspaper. And don't call him a gigolo. His name is Rossano Rubicondi. A few years later, Massimo Gargia and a group of friends walk into an after-hours bar in Rome, known for its famous clientele. There, among the night owls, sits Rubicondi. Rubicondi was a nobody, Gargia will recall. Very good-looking, amusing. He tried to go all the places in fashion, to know people, but without one penny. The supremely well-connected Gargia helps Rubicondi get a job as a salesman at the Versace boutique in London. And when Rubicondi learns that Gargia is close friends with Ivana Trump, he becomes fixated on meeting her. He was very pushy, Gargia says. At the ready-to-wear collection in Milan, Gargia is sitting with Ivana when Rubicondi appears. But Ivana isn't impressed. He's a little bit too vulgar, she tells Gargia. Rubicondi engineers a second meeting. He sold his car in London to go and see her in Palm Beach, says Gargia, with similar results. Fast forward to the French Riviera. Gargia has joined Ivana for a two-week cruise on her yacht, and Ivana, usually so effervescent, is uncharacteristically down. She was alone for more than 1 year, he says, and Ivana was not a woman who can be without a man. That's when Rubicondi turns up again. Finally, one night, she was drunk, and she brought him on the boat, says Gargia. The day after, she told me, I'm so happy, he's so nice. For 2 weeks, they cruised the Med. The 57-year-old soon-to-be grandmother, the kids called me Glamma or Ivanma, and the 30-something playboy, each able to party until 3 or 4 a.m., then hit the gym at 8 and start all over again. From dancing with the stars to the beach in Saint-Tropez, she is in love again, Ivana, again. I'd rather be a babysitter than a nursemaid, she will write. Friends who hear about the scandal with Francine Eternaud try to warn her, but Ivana is blinded by Rubicondi's charms. In the beginning, he was very charming, says Sirota. He bowed and kissed her hand, all the BS. He was very good company, you know, besides the sex, says Gargia. He was very good at sex, like all Italians. Rubicondi learns to speak English, his deep, booming baritone filling the drawing rooms and dance floors of the Upper East Side, Saint-Tropez, Aspen, and Gstaad, always with the lady paying. Signora was a mega financial support for him, says Paolo Alavian, owner of Ivana's regular neighborhood restaurant, Ristorante Altesi. He always wanted something, says Baroness Marianne von Brandstetter. He was like a lion in a cage, says his friend Roberto Manfi. He couldn't be who he wanted to be, a businessman. He would have 15 or 20 coffees in the morning before tennis, says Brandstetter. 10 to 12 Aperol spritzes, no problem, says Alavian. More dangerous than the espresso or the alcohol were the dreams. The scheme of the week, Haskell says of Rubicondi's endless quest to launch himself into the world of business. One day, he's going to open a pizza restaurant in Palm Beach. The next, he has a restaurant in Saint-Tropez, the short-lived Arisano. People would come at 11 o'clock to watch him and Ivana fight. Through it all, he is in the Ivana business, which might have been the toughest enterprise of all. It's very difficult to take advantage of Ivana, says Haskell. She sees through everything and everybody. He threatened her. If you don't marry me, I leave you, says Garja. Everybody was against. Me too. Ivana still believes in the impossible. She honestly believed that if she married Rossano, he might start behaving himself, and he would feel more secure, says her longtime London friend, advisor, and agent Liz Brewer. But that was unfortunately not the case. The wedding date is set, April 12, 2008. It will be a multi-million-dollar blowout, more than 400 guests, a 24-piece orchestra, 25 bridesmaids, 17 groomsmen, a 12-foot-tall imported wedding cake, all paid for by Ivana. Decorations, flowers, and arrangements like I've never seen, says Brandstetter, all under the eaves of Mar-a-Lago, with Trump reportedly waiving the $20,000 event fee. On March 17th, 2 weeks before the vows, the police raced to Ivana's Palm Beach home on Jungle Road, responding to a report of a disturbance. They were screaming, says Garja. Rossano wants money before the marriage. He wanted a piece of money she was getting for the wedding, says Haskell, who served as Ivana's maid of honor, and says Ivana earned about $2.5 million from wedding-related sponsorships. He was part of the show, and he wasn't going to sign the wedding certificate unless she gave him money. So she reluctantly gave him $75,000. Then, before the sovereigns of Trump world, Ruby Conde becomes a member of the family. Everyone wears white except Donald, who arrives in a black tuxedo. We are a construction company, and we have job sites. We lose people, Don Jr. says in his toast. You better treat her right, because I have a 45 and a shovel. At the wedding, Ruby Conde enters to the theme song from the movie Rocky. He sings, terrible, says Haskell, and dances until the party ends at 4 a.m. Then he disappears. Ivana's groom, who fed his bride day-old sandwiches at a 7-Eleven in the wee hours after their wedding, has gone first to Miami and then to Rome for a stint on the reality show L'Isola dei Famosi. She was hurt and didn't want it to get out that she wasn't honeymooning with Rossano, says Liz Brewer. So for 3 weeks, everyone assumed she was, even though she was home alone in Palm Beach. When he returns, and he always returns, the gallantry and even the sex evaporate and the fighting escalates. Rossano did not understand that Ivana was the chance of his life, says Garja. He thought he could get rid of her and have a career. He starts to treat her very bad. They are staying on a boat near Saint-Tropez. Ruby Conde has left for the evening, returning, like always, at 4 a.m., says Brandstetter. The ship soon sets sail. Ivana checked Rossano's bag, and she found a condom. She said, why do you have a condom? With me, you are not doing anything. She called the captain and said, stop the cruise. She wanted to leave Rossano in the middle of the ocean. The marriage lasts 1 year, but for the next 13 years, Ruby Conde boomerangs back and forth, despite marrying another woman in 2011. Without Ruby Conde, Ivana begins to unravel. In 2009, she is escorted from a plane set to fly from West Palm Beach to New York, after unleashing an F-bomb-heavy tirade over children playing in the first-class aisle. At some point, she reportedly enters rehab in Malibu, where she hosts a dinner for her fellow inmates and drinks forbidden champagne, according to the writer Ivana Lowell in Airmail. Then, the pandemic. She rarely ventures out of her East 64th Street townhouse. Instead, Ruby Condi comes thundering back in. "He wasn't a gigolo," says the model Kamini Chin Loy, who accepted Ruby Condi's marriage proposal on Italian TV in 2014. He and Ivana had this intense on-and-off relationship, but they still loved each other. If she called in the middle of the night, he was there for her. Needing money, he calls Ivana from Italy in 2020 to tell her that he is sick. She flies him back to New York, and the final scenes of her saga begin. "Paolo, tell this freaky Italian what I want," she tells Alavian at Ristorante Altese, which becomes the couple's second living room. "And I knew it was for Rossano to stop smoking," he says. She would say, "Stop smoking, and you can have anything you want." He will never stop. Not the daily pack of Marlboro Reds, not the multiple Aperol spritzes by day, and the endless Chianti and Fernet Branca, which he drank like water, by night. When he says he has been diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma and has only 4 months to live, Alavian thinks it's a lie, another scheme to get the money from La Signora. Ivana pays for his medical treatment at Memorial Sloan Kettering. His Upper East Side apartment, which she rents and furnishes, cost her $200,000, says Brandstetter. And she spends her time and energy trying to get him into remission. She had wanted to be a babysitter, but ended up a nurse, New York Magazine will report. On October 29th, 2021, Ruby Condi dies, taking part of her with him. "I think the day after that, Signora started to go down," says Alavian. She would sit in the back of his restaurant over a single glass of Pinot Grigio. She would say, "Do you mind to play it?" And I know she means Andrea Bocelli, Ave Maria. But Bocelli's rendition of Franz Schubert's 1825 funeral favorite only invokes the frenzied spirit of Ruby Condi. "Don't go to that place," Alavian warns her. "Don't be depressing yourself to die for him. I put on Celine Dion." He last sees her early on the evening before her death, walking toward his restaurant, her feeble steps, impaired by a hip injury, supported by her housekeeper, Fabiana. "Send me the carrot soup," she says. The next morning, he gets a call from his staff. "Something happened at La Signora's house. A lot of people. A police van." Her housekeeper isn't able to open the fortress-like steel front door, which is locked from the inside. Finally, a workman opens it by force. "I was told that Eric, who was very close to his mother, rushed over and held her in his arms until the police got there," says Haskell. Eric Trump declined to comment. But Ivana wouldn't want to reflect on all this death, darkness, and despair, not in the last moment of her life, because on July 14th, she isn't thinking about death. She is surely thinking about her impending flight to Saint-Tropez. The mayor has made a special exception for Ivana to land in a helicopter on the beach near her home, according to a friend, saving her the drive from the Nice airport and enabling her to have dinner with Garja immediately. She said, "I don't want to be alone," says Garja. Will she wear the red dress or the gold one? Both are packed in her luggage. She wanted to start to live again, says Garja. She might have even been ready to take another lover, once again commanding him to start looking. But between dusk and dawn, she takes that final step, tumbling down the stairs, dying of what the coroner will call blunt impact injuries. In the days after Ivana's death, I stood outside her townhouse and watched a young man pull out his iPhone and begin taking photographs, as if this house were one of the new tourist attractions of New York City. "This is home of Ivana Trump," he told me, in a distinctively Eastern European accent. Like Ivana, he mangled his English, but his admiration was clear. "The casket was gold, and she was wearing the gold dress," says Haskell. "Her hair was frozen forever in her famous hairstyle, and she looked like she was going to jump right up and out at any minute." Trump, who declined to comment to Vanity Fair, reportedly stood beside his ex-wife's open coffin during the viewing in the Frankie Campbell Chapel on Madison Avenue, pacing back and forth as if he were talking to her, says Vivian Sirota. Later that day, at the gravesite, Sirota waited until Trump was alone, then approached him and said, "You broke her heart. She loved you. She still loved you. And I know you loved her. You could have been the couple of the century. You made a mistake." He didn't say anything, she says, but when he turned around, there were tears running down his face. Little Gold Men by Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair's twice-weekly Little Gold Men podcast tracks the ups and downs of award season, featuring interviews with the contenders, real-time analysis, and actionable intelligence on the race to celebrate the best of Hollywood. It's the closest thing you can get to being inside the envelope. Subscribe now at vf.com/podcast. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.